Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Yesterday, August 6th, was USA Purple Heart Day to commemorate Americans wounded in war. It was also the 80th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, Japan, followed 3 days later by the second, and so far, last nuclear obliteration of a city, Nagasaki, also Japanese, both atomizations of which ended World War II in the summer of 1945. I start today's program with a repeat of a broadcast on this program of 22 August 2003, teaching about nuclear war. And it was something I wrote. Although school children conducted duck and cover drills throughout the Cold War, Americans have been reluctant to teach their children about nuclear war while building ever more grotesque weapons. An example is an attempt by Oregon to establish a curriculum pertaining to nuclear war in the state's public elementary and high schools during the height of the Cold War. The idea was to develop a program of the history of the nuclear age and the arms race that so quickly developed between the superpowers, the consequences of the use of nuclear weapons, the effects upon national economies and ambitions, and alternate forms of resolving conflict, short of war in general. The issue caused intense and heated debate. Supporters, mostly Democrats, said teaching children about war would be an important step toward averting Holocaust. Opponents, mostly Republicans, said it would create fear in children and weaken the nation's resolve to defend itself. Essentially, the people who did not want kids to know about nuclear war were those whose policies encouraged it. Clatsop County Democrat Tom Hanlon said, "Children are concerned about life in the nuclear age and should have their concerns addressed in the classroom." Eugene Representative Carl Hostica said giving children the opportunity to learn about nuclear war was the legislature's first concrete step toward preventing nuclear disaster. One who disagreed was Gold Beach Representative Al Schroeder, a Republican who compared nuclear education to sex education, which he said produced more pregnancies, abortions, and homosexuals than before it was taught. He said children were not taught to distinguish between good and evil, and that education about nuclear war would only brainwash them and dissolve their will in the struggle against the evil empire. His opinions represented the far right, but were not substantially different from more moderate Republicans, such as John Minnis from Portland, a former policeman and member of the state legislature, who thought teaching about nuclear war would coerce children into accepting what he called a global philosophy that would countenance global government. Minnis said educating children about nuclear weapons would undermine their national allegiance and indoctrinate them in extremist politics, and that schools were inadequate to teach about nuclear war. His opinion was children should be taught how to think and grasp fundamentals before such dramatic and complex issues as the nuclear arms race were put before them. And he said elementary children in particular were too young to understand and too prone to anxieties and nightmares about what the Course might reveal to them. Minnis was an ardent supporter of Star Wars, which he claimed would end the nuclear arms race with more certainty than a nuclear freeze. He said that arguments about nuclear weapons were more volatile than the weapons themselves. He felt anti-nuclear groups would use the schools to manipulate children into opposing nuclear weapons. The major flaw in the argument that parents should be responsible for teaching their children about nuclear war, not the schools, was that most adults then and now do want to know or think about it themselves. A 10-year-old girl wrote a letter to an Oregon newspaper during the nuclear school debate. She had just watched a TV movie about nuclear war, The Final Day, and she was afraid for her future. "I don't want war to happen," she wrote. "If a bomb does explode now, I think I would rather die than live. Now, when I think of my future, I think of nothing. I hope a war will never happen." Was she afraid because she knew so little or too much about the consequences of a nuclear war? And now, something I wrote for my Once Upon a Time newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. Summers of Love and War, with a quote by Abby Hoffman. "You cannot have change without the young. The young have the creativity. They have the energy. They have the impatience. You need the youth to dissent." All sorts of people in prime middle age are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the summer of love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly pampered middle and upper-class white flower children, briefly abandoned social strictures and sang, danced, and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors to have done in the primeval veldt before civilization and Christianity dampened our freewheeling pagan spirits. Mecca, that legendary summer of 1967, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the Bay, historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quicksilver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms. A song that summer urged westward bound immigrants, "If you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair." An ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking: food, lodging, medical care, sex, and wine. Even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace, and love. It all went badly quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and faraway summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggles of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week. And God, Buddha alone knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture that grew from the summer of love produced its most infamous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s are set apart from other decades. They are different, not so much for their intensity. The World War II years were far more intense. Or because they were flamboyant and colorful. The jazz age of the 1920s had more splash. Or for that matter, because they were fueled by division and insurrection. The 1770s and 1860s make better claims. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or perhaps more aptly, with a single, immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil rights movement of primarily disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction and the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 American dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the Vietnam War came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism, a new left, quote unquote, replaced the old left, and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled gypsy law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few were inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the young once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the 1967 summer of love and flower power was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations, generally set off by police and National Guards, armed with clubs, guns, and gas. the presidential campaign failed to change anything. The new Republican administration that was elected despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever. 2 years later, culminating in the shooting deaths of 4 white students at Kent State in Ohio and at least 2 blacks, both women, at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government, under Richard Nixon, also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution. The Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts, and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968 was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked. Not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, if anyone remembers, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak. The Winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe Sanh, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war. The devastation of the ancient imperial city of Hue and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, and was murdered moments after victory in the California primary in June. In August 1968, a peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although culturalists claim the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire the later anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion, and added hardened veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. The war veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war, cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were two mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited a far and exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately diffused the rebellion. Draft-age males, assured of avoiding combat service, lost interest in the immorality of the war and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy, driven by hopeful or grim visions. The New Left dissipated into a pabulum of New Age kitsch. There were always contradictions among the countercultures of the 1960s. Hip culture chasing a buck, in contrast to politicized hippies who wanted to abolish wealth. Nirvana seeking acid heads versus hardcore speed freaks and junkies. But everybody was against and in fear of the cops. The flower power dream of transcending materialism with goodwill failed, but not before it seeded the environmental movement and made ideas about pacifism, justice, and equality respectable. The most far-reaching legacy of the inspired and self-indulgent 1960s is the women's movement. The lingering problem, however, is that the fun-seeking nation adopted the sex, drug, and party habits of the young boomers, but not the philosophies or politics. Young Ben Braddock, as portrayed by Dustin Hoffman in the film version of The Graduate, written by Charles Webb, spoke for a disillusioned generation of baby boomers in early maturity when he said, "I don't know what I am, Dad, and I don't particularly care." Later, that spiritual emptiness would gorge on frenzied materialism, but for a short period, a large number of primarily affluent young Americans attempted to combat cultural nihilism with experiments toward a moral republic, which was to be lightly governed for the benefit of all persons by intelligent goodwill. Some among the large restless tribe that worshiped the image of eternal youth never got much older, swept up in the war that everyone seemed powerless to stop. A few endured jail to avoid the war or sought exile in other countries. Others resisted the war and defiantly braved guns, clubs, and disabling chemicals of police and National Guardsmen, many of whom enlisted in state militias to avoid service in the war. The drugs that opened the minds of thousands of alienated children seared them to ash in subsequent years. Although the baby boom generation temporarily repudiated the corrupt leadership and incessant greed of the nation, rapidly germinating and degenerating, dizzily heady ideologies and social solutions, it grew increasingly fond of the riches it had previously loathed. Most softened their resistance to the 7-11 values of their culture as they grew older. Communal patterns in politics were abandoned. Business networking among the former rebels replaced communalism. The happily acquisitive, workaholic, well-dined yuppie metamorphed from the angst-driven flower child hippie who thought universal love and open sex would make the world a better place. Yuppies contortedly justified their pursuit of wealth and status as fully compatible with their lingering sympathies for social justice. Now the baby boomers, who made so much trouble to their families and their country while they were growing up, are as old or older, much older, than their parents a generation ago. The war that traumatized their vulnerable youth is long over, although its residue continues to disturb amnesia. The psychopathic Cold War they grew up with ended abruptly with the collapse and disintegration of the Russian Communist Empire. The summer of love was the generation's iridescent mirage, the watershed of its vanished youth. They were born after World War II, and their memories do not include the daily sounds of bombers and bombs that tormented and killed children all over the world a few years earlier. Yet their continuing angst is a legacy of their parents' war. They were born under the sign of the mushroom cloud. More than their rebellion against prosperity and its flaccid corruption of spirit, their dread of nuclear holocaust defined their passionate protest against the Vietnam War. More even than personal fears of young males, they would be drafted into it. This first nuclear generation, also the first television generation, felt a shared stake in the future, and apart from hype and herd instinct, they tried to be kind to one another. They are so large a generation, they crash through history as irresistibly as fire, remaking everything they sweep past. They are so accustomed to the attention of society, particularly its merchants, they believe they are the force of history itself. And that was something I wrote, Summers of Love and War. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program.